here on VOA.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, more warnings to Russia regarding Ukraine. Search for the missing Malaysian passenger plane continuing. Plea to help the needy of Syria, plus human rights groups condemning a Cairo court verdict. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukrainian Interior Minister Arsen Avakov said 70 protesters were arrested in an anti-terror operation to drive out pro-Russian demonstrators who seized a government building in the city of Kharkiv. The demonstrators are demanding referendums on splitting from Ukraine, the same kind of vote that took place last month in Crimea. And here in Washington, the White House says it has evidence that some of those protesters are not local Russian speakers, but were brought in from elsewhere and paid to start trouble. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke Tuesday before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. His testimony dealt with recent events in Ukraine, Russia's involvement in what's happening there, and what the U.S. and its allies intend to do about it.
The intense focus on Ukraine continues. And everything that we've seen in the last 48 hours from Russian provocateurs and agents operating in eastern Ukraine tells us that they've been sent there determined to create chaos. And that is absolutely unacceptable. These efforts are as ham-handed as they are transparent, frankly. And quite simply, what we see from Russia is an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state and create a contrived crisis with paid operatives across an international boundary engaged in this initiative. Russia's clear and unmistakable involvement in destabilizing and engaging in separatist activities in the east of Ukraine is more than deeply disturbing. No one should be fooled, and believe me, no one is fooled, by what could potentially be a contrived pretext for military intervention, just as we saw in Crimea. It is clear that Russian special forces and agents have been the catalyst behind the chaos of the last 24 hours. Some have even been arrested and exposed. And equally as clear must be the reality that the United States and our allies will not hesitate to use 21st century tools to hold Russia accountable for 19th century behavior. We have stated again and again that our preference, and the preference of our friends and allies, is de-escalation and a diplomatic solution. But Russia should not for a single solitary second mistake the expression of that preference as an unwillingness to do what is necessary to stop any violation of the international order. At NATO last week, and in all of my conversations of the past weeks, it is clear that the United States and our closest partners are united in this effort. Despite the costs, and willing to put in effect tough new sanctions on those orchestrating this action and on key sectors of the Russian economy. In energy, banking, mining, they're all on the table. And President Obama has already signed an executive order to implement these sanctions if Russia does not end its pressure and aggression on Ukraine.
That is U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula has placed the spotlight on NATO. Secretary Kerry just mentioned last week's meeting in Brussels, where the alliance made some decisions about its relationship with Russia in light of the annexation. VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshna taking a look now at NATO's response to the current crisis over Crimea and eastern Ukraine.
Experts say Russia's military incursion into Ukraine and its annexation of Crimea was a wake-up call for the 28-member NATO alliance. Charles Kupchin, NATO expert at Georgetown University, says since the end of the Cold War, the Western alliance has been trying to redefine its mission.
A few months ago, people were talking about an existential crisis for the alliance in the absence of the mission in Afghanistan. The bulk of NATO troops are scheduled to be out by the end of 2014. And the question was, okay, what next? And now I think there is a revival of NATO's traditional mission of collective defense.
That policy stipulates that an attack on one member is an attack on all of them. During a recent NATO meeting, Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen reaffirmed the alliance's commitment to collective defense, saying, "We will deter and defend against any threat."
We have already reinforced NATO's presence on the eastern borders of the alliance. We are flying AWACS surveillance patrols over Poland and Romania. We have more than doubled the number of fighter aircraft allocated to the NATO air policing mission in the Baltic states.
Poland and Romania are NATO members that border Ukraine on the west. Russia has amassed thousands of troops on its border with Ukraine, prompting Western experts to say an incursion into eastern Ukraine is likely. Charles Kupchin says NATO would react even more to protect its members.
You would see a considerable expansion in the moves that NATO has already taken to beef up defenses on its eastern frontier, perhaps even including reneging on the gentleman's agreement that was struck when Central European members entered NATO, which was to say to the Russians, we will not forward deploy substantial numbers of NATO troops in Central Europe.
Kupchin says NATO's reaction will be short of war.
The prospect of a clash between NATO forces and Russia over Ukraine is effectively out of the question. And that's because there has been an assessment on this side of the Atlantic as well as in Europe that what has happened and what could potentially happen in Eastern Europe, in Eastern Ukraine, is not the stuff of war. That is to say, war between the Western democracies and Russia.
Sean Kay, NATO expert at Ohio Wesleyan University, agrees. But he says Russian forces will have a difficult time if they enter eastern Ukraine.
There's not a lot we can do to stop them, but their military capabilities are actually still pretty thin. They can do a thing like the Georgia War, but that was a pretty small conflict with highly trained and integrated forces. But to sustain a large deployment of forces over a very long period of time in a hostile territory, that's going to be difficult for the Russians to do.
Charles Kupchin puts it this way.
For Putin to head into eastern Ukraine, he opens a Pandora's box. He risks a civil war on his border. He risks miring Russian troops in something that could look like another Afghanistan.
As a result of Russia's military intervention in Crimea, NATO has suspended all civilian and military cooperation with Moscow. NATO officials say they will review their relationship with Moscow in view of Russia's actions. Andrei Dineshner, VOA News, Washington.
Ukraine's Petro Poroshenko, a self-made confectionery magnate worth an estimated $1.3 billion, has emerged as the frontrunner in opinion polls leading up to Ukraine's presidential election, which is scheduled for next month. The surveys show the one-time foreign minister will well ahead of his main rival, former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. Henry Ridgewell profiles now the man who has pledged to rescue Ukraine's economy as well as face down Russia.
Petro Poroshenko is known as the Chocolate King in Ukraine, having built a fortune on confectionery, but he is no stranger to politics. He was a regular speaker at Kiev's Independence Square at the height of the recent protests, denouncing corruption and calling for membership of the European Union. Arisia Lutsevich is at the London-based policy institute Chatham House.
He became so popular during the recent protest because he was giving some kind of confidence in terms of his direct action and also because he was not affiliated with the existing political parties.
Poroshenko has received the backing of opposition leader and former boxer Vitali Klitschko. In a recent interview, Poroshenko said he would build on Ukraine's revolution.
It was born the new country. It was born the new people. But unfortunately, it left old politician. And I tried to do my best that the politician, the government, the authorities, and the president be adequate to the new people from the revolution.
Poroshenko played a big role in the Orange Revolution in 2004, alongside his now rival Yulia Tymoshenko, becoming foreign minister under the then president Viktor Yushchenko. He built his fortune on the back of his giant chocolate company, Roshen, alongside media and manufacturing interests. Observers say he is cultivating an image as a safe pair of hands.
You can come here in a very safe, in a very nice country, yeah, with a very experienced labor, with a very effective cheap cost for the creation of the businesses. And the only obstacle for doing that is the corruption. That's why is it a top priority during the modernization.
His status as a self-made billionaire sets him apart from Ukraine's other business elites, who are often seen as corrupt, says Arisia Lutsevich of Chatham House.
He has good understanding of the way international financial markets are working, and he is on good term basis with a lot of Western politicians. But also, you know, he is somebody who understands Russia, because he's doing a lot of his business with the confectionery and sugar industries are in Russia.
But Poroshenko's relations with the Kremlin are poor, says Russia specialist Andrew Foxall of analyst group the Henry Jackson Society.
His Russian confectionery business was subject to trade sanctions and embargoes by the Russian government. The business lost an awful lot of money. He lost an awful lot of money. More recently, Poroshenko's assets in Russia have been targeted.
Petro Poroshenko has said he will never accept Russia's forceful annexation of Crimea. Russia has deployed tens of thousands of troops along the Ukrainian border. Whoever wins the May 25th election, victory will mark just the beginning of the daunting challenges that face Ukraine's next leader. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
It has been 1 month and 1 day since Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 disappeared on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 people aboard. The search continues for the plane now in the southern Indian Ocean, where in recent days they have been trying to find the origin of faint sounds, which could be from the plane's flight data recorders, also known as black boxes. Search crews on Tuesday failed to locate the pinging sounds that officials said were consistent with the plane's black boxes. Angus Houston, the retired Australian Air Chief Marshal who is heading the search operation off of Australia's west coast, said sound locating equipment on board Australia's ship, the Ocean Shield, has picked up no trace of the signals since they were first heard over the weekend.
There have been no further contacts with any transmission, and we need to continue that for several days, right up to when the point at which there's absolutely no doubt that the ping of batteries will have expired. So it'll be several days more. Now, until we stop the pinger search, we will not deploy the submersible.
Time is running out to find the devices, as their locator beacons have a battery life of about a month. Australia's Defence Minister David Johnson said more than 130 search missions have been completed so far, up to 14 planes, and as many ships continue to focus on a single search area, covering more than 77,500 square kilometers of ocean and 2,270 kilometers northwest of the Australian city of Perth. A U.S. website that monitors North Korea's nuclear program says recent satellite imagery suggests Pyongyang may be having difficulties maintaining proper water cooling systems at two of its nuclear reactors. The analysis found South Korean President Park Geun-hye's appeal for an end to the nuclear activities of the North, fearing its nuclear material could fall into the hands of extremists or cause a Chernobyl-like disaster. James Acton of the Nuclear Policy Program of the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace tells VOA's Victor Beatty while President Park might have been overstating the case of a large-scale nuclear catastrophe, a mishap at the Yongbyon reactor is a distinct possibility.
An accident will be enormously serious. It's unlikely to be on the Chernobyl scale. That said, there's also no doubt in my mind that the reactors at which an accident is most likely of all the reactors in the world is the North Korean ones. The probability of an accident there is higher than anywhere else. The evidence that's come out over the last few days, I think, has just reinforced that impression. What happened was there was a big flood. It destroyed, buried in sand, some of the pumping equipment that was used to cool the reactors. Now, the North Koreans were able to either turn off or reduce the power of the reactor they had operating, and so there was no accident on this occasion. But I think this series of events demonstrates the vulnerability of their safety systems to potential external hazards, like flooding, for instance. The only largest reactor that's operating on the Yongbyon site is the 5-megawatt reactor, and that's there as a plutonium production reactor, and that was the one that was reduced power or shut down. And there's some pretty persuasive evidence, I think, from satellite imagery by the 38 North website that demonstrates that following that flooding, the reactor was either shut down or its power was reduced. So, for instance, one of the most interesting pieces of evidence is that normally when snow falls on top of the reactor, it melts quickly because the reactor is producing a lot of heat. Actually, there's satellite imagery a few days after snowfall that still shows snow on the roof of the reactor, when normally you wouldn't expect to observe that. So it's evidence like that that is pretty convincing evidence that the reactor was either shut off or its power was reduced significantly.
This all comes as North Korea had warned in recent days of a new form of nuclear test. What might they mean?
Well, it's not at all clear what they mean. There's a number of different things they could potentially mean. There's two fissile materials, two nuclear materials you can use to make a nuclear weapon out of. We don't know for certain, but it's possible that all of their previous tests used plutonium. Maybe they're threatening to use the other material, highly enriched uranium, in this test. Maybe they have a more advanced design that could produce a bigger explosive power, what's called a boosted fission device. Maybe it's possible they've successfully miniaturized a device that can now fit on the nose cone of a ballistic missile. Those are three possibilities. There's plenty of others. And frankly, I don't think we know what the North Koreans meant yet.
The United States announced that it's sending two more missile defense ships to Japan following North Korean ballistic missile launches. I'm just wondering if you believe that that might be a signal that the United States knows the North is about to do something that it hasn't done for a while.
I don't think so. I mean, look, in a general sense, we're expecting another nuclear test this year. It's not certain, but I think it's pretty likely. I think it's pretty likely the North Koreans may test another long-range missile this year. I don't think anyone expects North Korea to fire missiles at Japan or anyone else in the region. Rather, I think these ship deployments serve two purposes. They send a message to Japan. The U.S. is saying, we've got your back here. We're not abandoning you. And they send a message to North Korea that says exactly the same thing. We're not abandoning Japan. It's our regional ally. Don't think you can bully Japan around or anyone else in the region.
James Acton is with the Nuclear Policy Program at the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. World Food Program is warning now of a looming drought in Syria that could put millions of lives at risk. Syria suffers a severe drought in 2008, which persisted into 2010. Vulnerable communities, affected areas of the country barely had a chance to recover from food shortages and rising prices arising from the event before it was plunged into a civil war in 2011. The WFP warns that 6.5 million people could be at risk of acute food shortages and they will need international aid to survive. WFP spokesperson Elizabeth Beers tells VOA rainfall since September has been less than half the long-term average.
There is only 1 month left in the rainfall season that lasts until mid-May. And with three-quarters of the rainfall season gone, it is unlikely there will be a significant recovery in this agricultural season. I'm just saying that this situation is of concern because it will add another problem on top of the conflict consequence impact for the people who already need urgent life-saving assistance.
WFP finds dry conditions affecting the wider Middle East and compound the impact of civil war on the agricultural sector. Report says that northwestern Syria, in particular Aleppo, Idlib, and Hama governorates, are the worst affected. Meantime, the UN Refugee Agency spokesperson Fatemata Lejunkaba says a major drought could lead to more displacement.
We can expect more refugees to leave if, on top of the conflict, they feel that their lives are in danger because there is no food. But it's hard to say, obviously, how many, because they could also move to other parts of Syria.
World Food Program says it hopes to reach 4.2 million displaced people in Syria with food assistance this month, but it notes it is short of cash, so beneficiaries will have their food rations cut by about 16%. The agency says it requires around $41 million every week to meet the food needs of people affected by the conflict in Syria. An Egyptian court has sentenced four gay men to prison for committing homosexual acts. The Egyptian press says the men were accused of holding deviant sex parties and dressing as women. Edward Uranian is in Cairo with our report.
The ruling handed down by the Egyptian court received little attention in the local media, where homosexuality is a serious taboo. Three of the men were given 8 years in prison, while a fourth received a three-year sentence, according to Egypt's Ahram Online. The names of the men were not published, ostensibly to avoid embarrassing their families. Human rights groups, both in and outside of Egypt, condemned the verdict, but VOA was unable to get local groups to talk about the subject on the record. Homosexuality is treated as a crime in more than 30 countries on the African continent. A well-known Egyptian sociologist who asked that his name not be used tells VOA that homosexuality is not frequently prosecuted in Egypt, and the police are usually busy with more serious issues. But, he said, when a case is brought to their attention, they are often forced to take it to court. He says homosexuality has been talked about in Egyptian cinema, including in the well-known film The Yacoubian Building, but that there is still an enormous stigma attached to being gay.
It is even worse than being atheist. I mean, we have atheists who come out, but you cannot find homosexuals who come out and say, hey, I am homosexual. And that shows you the degree difference in dealing with this issue.
A prominent Islamist who was eventually excluded from the presidential election in 2012, Hazem Abu Ismail, was blasted by the Egyptian press for allegedly being gay. Abu Ismail denied the charge, but such allegations can ruin the careers of politicians and prominent actors alike. A professor of politics at a Cairo university who also asked that her name not be used told VOA there is a great deal of hypocrisy in Egyptian society about homosexuality, and it is often difficult to even speak about it without arousing indignation. The court rulings against the four men are subject to appeal and could eventually be reduced or thrown out by another court. The ruling in a 2001 court case against 52 men charged with debauchery was thrown out on appeal, although the men were eventually retried and resentenced. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
International Monetary Fund says the global economic recovery is strengthening. The Washington-based agency projecting that the world economy will advance 3.6% this year, up 3% last year. It said it will again increase in 2015, moving ahead 3.9%. IMF says geopolitical risk have increased as well, but not yet at a global economic impact. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here today on the Voice of America for International Edition. It was good to have you with us. You know, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Kelvin Fowler, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On April 9th, 1626, English philosopher and statesman Sir Francis Bacon died. When charges of corruption forced his retirement from government service, he turned to literary and scientific activities and is known as an advocate of inductive reasoning and the scientific method. On this date in 1682, the French explorer Robert La Salle claimed the lands around the mouth of the Mississippi River for France, renaming the territory Louisiana in honor of King Louis XIV. In 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee met with Union General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia to discuss terms of surrender. The surrender effectively ended America's Civil War, a conflict that resulted in over a million casualties. In 1867, the United States Senate agreed by a single vote to a treaty purchasing the territory of Alaska from Russia. In 1914, the first full-color movie was shown. The film shown in London was titled The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. In 1939, noted singer Marian Anderson performed to a crowd of 75,000 gathered at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Anderson had been denied entrance to the racially segregated Constitution Hall, but had been invited by the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, to sing at the memorial. In 1940, Nazi Germany invaded Norway and Denmark. In 1959, the U.S. space agency NASA introduced seven astronauts to the public. They would take part in America's first manned space program, Project Mercury. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late March, as part of the U.S. government's drive toward gender equality and global elimination of gender-based violence, or GBV, the Department of State, working through its Bureau for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, introduced the Gender-Based Violence Emergency Response and Protection Initiative. This program aims to provide immediate financial assistance for survivors of severe gender-based violence, as well as for those who find themselves under threat of imminent attack due to their gender or gender identity. This is a first-of-its-kind global program dedicated to aiding survivors of extreme forms of gender-based violence everywhere. The network will be funded by the State Department and run by a consortium of non-governmental organizations. Those organizations include Vital Voices Global Partnership, ProMundo U.S., the International Organization for Migration, and the American Bar Association Rule of Law Initiative. The new Gender-Based Violence Emergency and Protection Initiative builds on and complements past U.S. efforts to eliminate gender-based violence, said U.S. Deputy Secretary Robert Burns. It has three clear objectives. First, survivors of gender-based violence will help receive urgent support, like immediate medical help, emergency shelter, psychosocial support, and legal assistance. Second, the program will provide targeted training for governments and civil society on GBV-related laws and advocacy. These trainings support men and women working to put an end to gender-based violence. And finally, all partners in the initiative will work to develop a regional and international network of service providers and activists in 11 country hubs. From Mexico to Mali and Tajikistan to Thailand, these networks will share data, lessons learned, and best practices, coordinate emergency responses, and work together on shared advocacy efforts, said Deputy Secretary Burns.
Gender-based violence is an inexcusable crime and an affront to dignity and human rights. It robs people, disproportionately women and girls, of their potential and threatens their mental, physical, and reproductive health. It denies economic opportunity and undermines economic growth. And it imperils the safety and stability of communities and of countries.
To make a lasting impact, he said, we need to match the scope of this challenge with the intensity of our response. It will require each and every one of us to stay focused, to continue to marry words with deeds, and to never be content with cheering from the sidelines when we can join the global effort to end the epidemic of gender-based violence once and for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.